CliffCentral.com.
Yeah, CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning. The Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's, is back, and lots of people very excited about that. I hope you are too. I'm keen to get ourselves stuck into some big stories because there are lots of things to talk about this morning, and we're going to get into them in just a minute. Lots of email feedback from last year that we've also got to get to. But this morning, with Pumi Mashiho, we are going to talk to Nick Hudson from Panda. He's the co-founder of Pandemics Data and Analytics. And, you know, we haven't spoken to Nick in some time. I had him on my TV show probably about 3 months back. And it's about time we did a little check-in with them to find out what they're up to. We're into lockdown level 3 in case you have been under a rock. And Nick has many thoughts on this, so we're going to talk to him about that too. And he writes that a repeated failing of COVID public health policy has been the absence of clear assessments of priorities and trade-offs. We're going to have to find out exactly what he means from that in a minute. But this is our regular Thursday meeting. We've been having these long before Cyril started his family meetings. And Pumi's obviously become an important and integral part of the recipe on a Thursday, and I'm delighted for it. This morning also, Nick Hudson, a return champion, who is going to join us. So, Nick, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm here, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Nick? What's been happening with you?
Oh, the usual busyness and dealing with all the malarkey. but all's well in our world.
Have you had?
How are you, Gareth?
Yeah, good. Have you had any very irritating things happen to you as a result of level 3, or have you also, just like many of us, gone, thrown your hands up and just tried to make the best of a situation which seems to be gripping the whole world? You can't feel like it's just our government making stupid decisions.
I've had nothing in particular. I don't know, it's definitely just not just our government. This seems to be a global pandemic of stupidity. Yeah. But no, I haven't had any major inconveniences, nothing that would admit complaining of, I would say.
All right, so Nick, let's just start off by re-familiarizing people with what it is you guys do. Panda is a collective of people that were brought together. It's not an organization that was founded with, a board and funding and political backers. It was just a group of people who were concerned that we were not necessarily getting proper information during the opening stages of this pandemic. There were things that were being ignored by the media. There were things that were being put out by government, which were questionable. And a lot of people have said that you guys are questionable. So just reestablish your credentials for people who don't know who you guys are.
Yeah, sure, Gareth. You're right. We started off as a group of friends with no particular background in anything to do with epidemics. The only thing that we can say is that initial group was quite diverse. There was a doctor, an actuary, a lawyer, and an economist. Mm-hmm. And then we were concerned. We looked at this and said, wow, the reaction to what we're facing is massively disproportionate to what is there, based on what we were reading about the early countries that were going through their epidemics, and that in particular the what went on that cruise ship, the Diamond Princess. And we were worried that people weren't taking into account the consequential or collateral damage from lockdowns.
Right.
And we got active on social media. We wrote a paper called Quantifying Years of Life Lost to Lockdown. By then, we'd added quite a few people to our group, and this was a task particularly well-suited to the actuarial people who work in the insurance world, who understand the relationship between the economy and so we wrote that paper, and it garnered quite a bit of attention. Mm-hmm. We started adding left, right, and center scientists of various varieties, virologists, immunologists, epidemiologists, and we started looking at various aspects of the epidemic. And the organization just grew and grew in momentum. You're right, it's completely a volunteer organization. We're not aligned with anybody of any political or corporate persuasion. Mm-hmm. The funding initially was purely from the members, then some speaking engagements, and then donations from the general public. And we were invited into the modeling consortium meetings. We made our comments. They were ignored. Time has proven that those comments were completely correct. And we began to get very frustrated. We realized that this was not about the science. People were
on that note. I mean, let's go into that, because this is really where I feel like we need to have conversations and pick up where we left off. So where have you guys been right, and have you been wrong in any of your assessments? Because we've seen all over the world how horribly wrong the initial modeling was, the stuff that came out from I think his name was Neil Ferguson, who made those initial calculations that got the whole world terrified that we, you know, 10 million people were going to die, that South Africa was primed because we have, immunocompromised populations, and we have people with TB, that we were going to be wiped out by this disease. Mm. Obviously, all of that stuff has been proven to be horribly wrong on a massive, massive scale, and that the costs thereof can be calculated. But all the things that you guys predicted and that you've said since Panda was established, how much have you got right and how much have you got wrong? How can we track your success?
Failure? I mean, I think what have been the central messages? I think on the central messages, which is that lockdowns were not advised under any pre-COVID science, that the downside impacts of lockdowns were not being factored in. All of that kind of reasoning was 100% intact. When you spend 8 months prognosticating about a complex thing like an epidemic, yes, you're right, you're going to get some things wrong. The biggest one that we failed to anticipate was the size of this resurgence now that's going on right now. We thought that and the timing of it. We thought that this disease would go into a kind of an endemic mode, and that was it's very interesting. We've gone through it and worked out, well, how did we get that wrong and why? And everybody got it wrong. Nobody was modeling a December midsummer a resurgence of this magnitude. So we kind of, why did everybody miss this? What's going on? And we haven't fully understood and unpacked that. But what we can say is the following, that was rooted in an observation which we made in May, June, which was that if you looked at the international data series and drew the relationship between the number of deaths that a country was having and its stringency of lockdown, there was no relationship whatsoever. Mm. And I think we incorrectly inferred from that lockdowns were just having no impact. What was, we think, more likely the case is that lockdowns were actually storing up later impact, and that what would emerge over time is that you would see that countries that had stringent lockdowns actually had higher death rates. And I think we're going through that. That's the one sort of tentative perspective that I would
If that's true, because I remember that the example that everybody was talking about was Sweden. Subsequently, we've got some interesting results out of Japan. But has Sweden failed? Because I hear people talking about how, you know, now Sweden is starting to implement their own restrictions and regulations, and that this is some sort of capitulation to the fact that lockdowns are a better system for a country to adopt than non-lockdowns. Is that true?
No. You've got to be very careful reading articles from media who want to put a spin on things, because if you look at the most reliable statistic you can see in Europe is what's called the Euromomo report. It's a mortality monitoring report for all of the European countries on a standardized basis. And if you look at that, you can see very clearly that Sweden has not had any significant excess mortality this winter. They're going through their winter right now. Mm. And all the headlines about the disaster and chaos in Sweden are completely contradicted by that simple observation. You just open that thing, it's online, it's a very easy thing to read, Euromomo reports. You go and have a look there. You can see they had their spike at the beginning, and then right now what they're dealing with is normal seasonal respiratory virus season mortality. So it's, as far as I can tell, it's been an outrageous success.
I have a question, and this is something that I've been thinking about. Hello, Nick. That I've been thinking about quite a lot. Is it not also a case of not having had enough time? So, scientifically, if I think about things like smoking and cancer, right? The bad effects of smoking on the body. It took many years of elimination of kind of going, this doesn't work. We started out with Marlboro using doctors smoking for their ads, you know, to a place now where we all agree that smoking is bad for you. Is it, at the beginning, and I don't know why everybody stopped saying that it's a novel virus, this. Have we just not had enough time to be able to look at all of the way that it works, the cycles of this thing, and everything is at the moment a bit of a trial and error?
I think there's an element of validity to that. Over time, knowledge always grows, and so you don't end up knowing less than you did when you started. And an epidemic is an unbelievably complicated thing. You're dealing with these sub-microscopic particles of virus. There's a lot of confusion about how it exactly transmits, the complexities of how it moves through a population, who it affects, the complexities of the policy response to the extent that they work, what is their impact, what are their benefits, what are their costs. Wow, you know, this is beyond the assessment of any one narrow field of science. You need very broad perspective and diverse team to look at this. And I think that, you will be right permanently. We will always be in a state of wishing we had the answer to some or other question. But the central features of this, the huge humanitarian cost of lockdown, and the fact that up until December 2019, you didn't find a healthcare policy institution who said anything but that lockdown should never be attempted. Their costs are too high. Their benefits are uncertain.
Who are the fans of this kind of thing? Because something like a curfew, let's just take that element of what we're in at the moment, level 3, 9 o'clock at night, you have to be at home. What does the curfew do in terms of the research that you've done? What does the idea, and this is something that's come up anecdotally with a lot of people I've had conversations with, the fact that if essentially these lockdowns, what they do is they force more people into less places, which actually has the opposite effect of containing something, and it actually spreads it. I mean, if we're all in the shops, because that's the only place we can go to get food, and we're in close proximity to each other, that's likely to be the number one place that we're picking up disease, no matter how much hand sanitizer there is or how many masks are being worn. What is your take on that, and do curfews and lockdowns do any good at all? Is there research to back this up in any which way? And surely, if there is, government would be parading that research in front of us. What research has been done? It's now been a year almost.
Well, by governments, we see no evidence of research. We have had meetings with various agencies of government and challenged them on these points, and they never produce anything. They just keep on repeating the same old tired assertions that lockdown works or this or that works. They don't produce evidence. And I think it's part of the problem here is, the initial challenge we made was, please make sure you're doing a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah.
And we've also, in half a year or more, what has it been, 8 months, we've never seen one. There's no sign of a proper cost-benefit analysis being done with respect to any of this. And I completely agree with you. I mean, there's one particularly amusing one because it's so foolish. I'm sitting here in Knysna at the moment, and as you know, they closed the Garden Route beaches. Well, the other day after that first closure, where did I go? I went shopping. And all those people who would have been on the beaches are now inside the shopping malls in their throngs. And it's so crazy because the one thing we can sort of see from the data is that transmission maybe mainly happens indoors, not outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing we can see from the data is that vitamin D's got an effect, and that taking people out of the sun is probably a bad idea. So what you've done is removed people from a safe environment and put them in a less safe one. I wouldn't go as far as describing a shopping mall as unsafe, but it's definitely not as safe as a beach. So these policies are kind of knee-jerkish and sporadic and weird, and there's not a lot to back them up. Same with the alcohol ban. I mean, the costs are amazing. There are 300,000 people employed by the industry, and it's staggering the impact of that ban. It drives alcohol consumption from the legal, regulated, controlled, healthy kind of side of the industry to an unregulated, illicit side of the industry. And we saw that very clearly. You know, the people carry on drinking. They just get their booze from dangerous places. So, you know, there's not a lot of sense in this, and it is disturbing. And I think, you know, the answer to the question why they're doing this is one that increasingly absorbs my mental energy.
Pums?
Well, I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago, which was kind of comparing all of the various responses from various countries, those who seem to have got it right, those who seem to, and it's been a combination of things. But the one thing that stood out for me, which I think we're not doing as well as we could be doing in this country, is about communicating, right? It's about letting people know what to do, where to go, why this is being done, just constant communication and constantly letting people know what's going on. It's not enough that Zweli Mkhize is sending out a tweet every night that tells you how many new infections there are. That's not the kind of information that we seem to be needing.
No, it's
and
useless.
I'm looking at things like what they did in New Zealand. And granted, those are very small, very closed-off communities. But one of the things that consistently Japan as well did very well was the communicating to people in terms of expectations, why the decisions that are made will have an impact. And we don't get that. We don't have any of that here. You know, so people kind of just carry on with their lives.
It's interesting. I think you're right to focus on communication, because I think one of the problems that we've had here is there is a lot of communication, but it's actually not accurate in the sense that it causes the problem to be overstated, causes people to be fearful, and that fear is dangerous in itself. Yeah, I give the example of if you've spent your whole time trying to convince everybody that there's a very dangerous virus out there and we're all going to die if we don't wear masks and lock down. Then when somebody gets like a really mild infection, you know, with maybe just some very mild symptoms, they dismiss it as being not COVID and they carry on with their normal activities. But that probably is a COVID infection in this kind of situation where, you know, you've got an epidemic on the go. And so people are looking at it and saying, no, this can't be
I'm getting annoyed with the shifting of goalposts. I remember when we started this whole thing and it was 2 weeks so that we could get the health system ready for it. Then it was all about overrun hospitals. And I see this narrative being played out also in the UK and in the US and in countries all over Northern Europe and even in places like Brazil, you see these stories. So which countries have got it right? And how honest have they been with their people? Because we've also got to look at how compliant people are. And by compliance, I mean obedient and orderly. And Japan seems to have an interesting case study, which we haven't looked at before. So if you have any insights on that, please give them to us. And which countries have really screwed it up badly?
Yeah, I think Japan is an interesting case. You know, there was a point where it was almost as if they just got bored with testing people and they said, okay, well, we're just going to stop this. And it's kind of what they did was leave them in the domain of responding to medical problems as 100 years of medical science had taught them to do, which is to treat sick people and where it was important to establish what the cause of the person's illness was. And they didn't panic the whole citizenry. They didn't cause people to be full of fear and anxious, and which takes its toll, you know. Makes a population more susceptible, I believe. Can't prove that.
Well, no, certainly anecdotally, again, I went for a checkup yesterday and asked my doctor, and he said he's very concerned about the rise of psychiatric illnesses as a result of, of what this pandemic has done to people. And I mean, he's just one doctor, so it's, again, it's anecdotal. But it's useful information, and maybe when we do, in the fullness of time, as Pumi points out, get to do a proper analysis of this, we will discover that some of the long-lasting damage and some of the mental health and the emotional damage that's being done by lockdowns and by the fear that has been instilled in people. I mean, you turn on most news services now, and they've got a non-stop ticker tape of these outrageous numbers of people who are infected, most of whom will recover, most of whom are not even necessarily symptomatic. A friend of mine's wife came out here from America. And she was about to leave and go back, and she was tested, and she found out she was positive. There was nothing about her condition that gave her any inclination that she had been infected with COVID or that she'd she would have been tested positive. Have we got any idea of whether the testing is getting any better, Nick? Because that's also an area of some gray.
Plenty gray, but I mean, I can't let go of the first observation you made about the psychological impact. We've got an incredible scientific advisory board, and the second last addition to it was Professor Alan Townsend from the UK, a professor of psychology. And in my introductory conversation with her, where we were just explaining the organization and how it works and testing her for her willingness to participate, the stories that she told me just left me absolutely cold. It was chilled down the spine stuff. The impact on young people in particular was just devastating. I'm going to be doing, I decided then and there I'm going to interview her. I want to talk to her for an hour and just unpack all of that stuff because it's just gutting. So I think we are going to count the costs in terms of an epidemic of psychological effects for many years, especially among children. You know, when you take a child who's developing and put them behind masks and social distance them and so on, you are laying the seeds of long-term psychological damage when you do that.
Well, if you told any parents prior to 2020, if you said to any parent in the world, do you want to institutionalize your child and have them develop difficulties in reading other people's faces and have them develop difficulties in expressing themselves and put them in a cocoon of social media nut jobs and have them fed with a constant diet of fear and an intravenous drip of nervousness about other people. And every parent would have said, no, please, let's not do that. And yet it's where most parents have found themselves and their children, sometimes through no fault of their own or decision of their own.
Although I think it's an amplified state of what people have already been living with. I think what this pandemic has done is it's amplified, like we were speaking earlier in the day, that suddenly people realize that they have no hobbies because now they are forced to do something. And I think that state of heightened fear, that state of isolation, the constantly being drip-fed all sorts of ideas by social media is precisely what a lot of young people have been. And what the lockdown has done is it simply amplified the fact that that is the way that young people are. The spike in mental illness in young people has been something that has been steadily growing over the past couple of years. We're just now down. You know, it's kind of like when you close some of the senses, you more sharply feel the others. I think that's what we're seeing much more, an amplification of what people have been living with anyway.
So normal sort of psychological disturbances that wouldn't be debilitating in ordinary conditions are now pumped up to a level where they become a huge problem. I think that's partly true, but I'll give you a little example that set me thinking. The other day I went out for a hike, and on the way up to the trailhead, I walked past a family with young children. And this little girl, who couldn't have been older than 6 or 7 years old, when she saw me coming along the trail without a mask, and she didn't have one on either, she did this when she walked past me. Now, you know, to have programmed a 6 or 7 year old person to be scared of just any other human being that they're seeing, to be scared about what is it, you know, being infected by them, infecting them, you know, that is just, it's, there's something perverse and sick about it. But Gareth, sorry, your other question was also an excellent one about the testing.
Yeah.
There are enormous problems with this PCR testing, and some of them, you don't even have to do a scientific investigation to understand what the problem is. Okay, so just from the beginning, an important medical principle was let go at the beginning of this whole epidemic. Instead of saying a case is a person who's sick and who is then confirmed that the cause of the sickness is this virus, SARS-CoV-2, we went around spraying a test at people, including asymptomatic people who are not sick at all. And whenever that test came up as positive, that's a case. That is medical malpractice. It's never been done before. We further that by describing people who've tested positive, not just as cases, but sometimes as patients, as people who are not yet recovered.
Yeah.
Recovered from what? You know? They've been exposed to a virus and their immune systems have dealt with it. Where in that story are we dealing with a case? And so that was the first problem. But then what's emerged since then is that the paper that set off the protocols and regimes for PCR testing was not properly peer-reviewed and contained a huge number of errors. It's called the Corman-Drosten paper. And recently, about 2 months ago, it was in November sometime, early November, a group of scientists from around the world, top preeminent scientists, three of them are members of PANDA, went and unpacked that study in excruciating detail. And they wrote, put together a paper of their own called the Corman-Drosten Review. And that paper details 10 significant problems with that seminal paper that set off the whole testing protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And to date, 2 months later, the paper has had no response. And that's a very serious problem. It's the heart of an enormous scandal that will play out in the courts in Germany, the US, and to a lesser extent, Australia, in the coming months.
You see, and that story in particular, then, for me, it confirms one of my biggest fears about the expedience with which all of this information is being. So back then, there was nothing else. But what would we rather do? I think one of the sweet spots of what we're dealing with lies in the fact that if we don't take it seriously enough, do something, then there's a bigger chance. And I think that's what happened with Cyril, right? So the emotional part, unfortunately for Cyril, the emotional response, I think his emotional response was, there's a pandemic, everything that is projected is we're going to be exactly where this wave breaks, and I will not be the president that has done nothing
mm-hmm.
about it. And so his knee-jerk reaction was to go to the extreme end. But again, that is the information that was available at the time. And with each new discovery, what has to happen is we have to recalibrate. I think if we don't take this seriously enough, and I have personal experience of people who haven't been, even with all of the alarmist bells ringing, have not taken this seriously enough. A friend of our family's lost a 16-year-old child because she went and traveled, wasn't social distancing, none of all of that, came home, was symptomatic, and infected the rest of her family. Her 16-year-old child has since died. And all of that is the not taking it seriously enough, not listening, not being careful. And there are lots of things that you can do that are about being careful, simply because we don't have enough information about what to do correctly yet. So, so go ahead, Nick. That's the thing.
I, I get your argument. But let's just start where you started with the reaction of you have to do something, you know. Yes, I understand that there's a pressure in that direction. But you also have to keep an eye on what you're doing and try to measure whether it's having any benefit. Mm. And that's the thing we can't see, that attempt. There's a responsibility there. It's okay to have an emotional reaction for a few days and then maybe be knee-jerky for a few days.
Yeah.
But 300 days? I mean, come on.
Well, let me ask you this, because I'm also getting to the point now where I'm sick to death of COVID. I'm sick of hearing about it. There's a huge amount of fatigue that has set in with me. I don't care about when people tell me these anecdotal stories about someone who they know who's succumbed or someone else, whether they're infected or not, and people running around shouting to the hilltops that they're positive and please everybody stay away from me for 14 days or whatever it is. I'm just bored. Mm. And I think there's a lot of boredom that's set in. I know it sounds really insensitive, but I'm over it. And when someone tells me that they are COVID positive or negative or they know someone who is, I just zone out. And there must be a lot of that that's starting to impact how this disease is affecting people and how it's affecting their thinking around the disease too. What do you think the long-term consequences of that fatigue are going to be? Because people are just also, they're becoming numb to it. You know, like if you have the constant drip, drip, drip effect on people who are already feeling like discombobulated by this, this is probably going to result in a whole lot of people just abandoning the whole project personally anyway and just carrying on with their lives as best they can.
Yeah, and if they did that, I don't think it would be too consequential. I'm not sure that any of these NPIs really have a significant beneficial effects, NPIs being non-pharmaceutical interventions. Mm. So I don't think that would be where the problem is. But what I worry about is the extent to which people are going to end up distrusting the entire enterprise of science when they understand exactly how much they've been misled here.
Yeah,
that's a concern for me. I think science is an extremely powerful feature of the modern world. And what's really gone wrong is that the institutions have been captured by corporate interests and people of a certain political persuasion. And that's what's gone wrong, is the institutions. Those need reform. But I worry about people starting to doubt anything that is told to them by a person in a white coat. And that would be a tragedy. So that's my big concern. I can see some benefits. I mean, when people turn around and realize, you know, how much nonsense they've been fed, I think it could speed up some incredibly worthwhile reforms in the world. So there's upside. But like you, I'm exhausted. I am just so tired of, you know, here's a typical flow of conversation that I've had to deal with for 8 months. We say, the benefits of lockdown are nowhere in evidence. They have massive societal costs. Simple statement.
Right.
Okay. Then somebody at the SAMRC or the NICD, you don't take this epidemic seriously. If you spent a week in the ICU, you wouldn't say those things. Okay. What I'm actually saying to them, and have been saying for months, is guys, these measures make things worse.
Mm.
What difference would it make? And by the way, I've been asking to go and see the hospitals. You know, I would love to go on a tour of the hospital. But what would it make if I walk and I see people dying? Does my opinion that lockdown is making things worse then become less important to me or more important?
No, I mean, it's inconsequential.
And it's just the fact that we have scientists operating at this, what I can only describe as a completely immature, lose your shit kind of state of mind, is so disturbing for me.
Well, it's sort of like when you talk about coronavirus with anybody and they say to you, oh, well, my grandfather died, so you have no right to say anything, which is just a very stupid way to end an already stupid argument. I'd love to say that I care. It has nothing to do with the argument whether I care or not about your grandfather dying. It's completely unimportant when we're trying to identify trends that have massive consequences in the long term for populations. So I'm going to go back to my question. Are there countries who've done it right and are there countries that have done it wrong? Are there Are there communities that have done it right and communities that have done it wrong? Who in South Africa is getting it right, in your opinion? You've done the analysis.
So I think there are countries that have gotten it right. I think Sweden is the poster child. They got the focused protection idea right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The implementation wasn't perfect, but
sure.
And it's now you can see it. As I said, it's clear. Zero excess mortality or very low excess mortality in this wave compared to other countries in Europe, which are now going through the whole thing again and having to lock down and so on. And Sweden's not locking down. The measures they have are very mild, and it has become politicized. So that's one. Japan, another one, I think, where you can talk about their various specific actions, but the bigger picture there is they simply didn't panic. Taiwan's another one that appears to have dealt with it correctly. In South Africa, can you go down to a community level? Well, the interesting thing is probably Khayelitsha got it right.
Okay. Why?
Why? Because they had no alternative. Okay, and I'm not saying only Khayelitsha. Social distancing was never really plausible in the poorer communities of our country. And what you see now in this wave is that those communities have already borne the brunt of everything. I always put a lot of value on actually driving to visit and knocking around in a place for a while. And so I did that in mid-December. I went to Khayelitsha and I just spent some time there watching the behavior. Mask utilization was very low, like around 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the other place that I spent some time knocking around in, which was Constantia, the very wealthy suburb in Cape Town. And there, the mask compliance is through the roof. Yeah, you just don't see somebody without a mask. The social distancing is enabled. The kids go to school online. They're doing everything. But those communities, the Atlantic seaboard in Cape Town and those wealthy areas that locked down and followed all the NPIs and wore the masks, they're bearing the brunt of the second wave right now. And Khayelitsha is getting a very light impact on a relative basis.
Okay.
So by accident, by force of circumstance, I should say, those communities, I believe, got it right. They had the alternative. In general, one of the things that completely it doesn't surprise me, because I think human beings have an innate tendency to overestimate what I refer to as personal agency. You know, I think the tendency has been to place way too much emphasis on the public policy response and not enough emphasis on all the other things that affect an epidemic, this complex beast. So people go like, oh, they see one country with a high mortality rate and the one country with a low mortality rate, and they say, well, what did their governments do differently? Because that's where they go to. Hmm. Instead of saying, well, are there drivers, natural drivers for that? And the really stunning one in that regard is the entire Southeast Asian super region. So going all the way from New Zealand to India and, you know, from the Indian Ocean islands to Mongolia, has had this astonishingly light mortality, despite an enormous range of public policy responses.
And let's be fair also, to some degree, the rest of Africa as well.
Yes.
South Africa is a bit of an outlier in that respect. So have you figured out why?
So we haven't, okay, and you'll never get definitive answers, because I think there are lots of factors.
Mm.
We must always be humble in that regard. Never pin anything onto one factor, because it's a complex situation. But what has emerged is in Tanzania, they did a study and found that there was a lot of pre-existing immunity. And people, when I say that, people say, well, that's not possible. It's a new virus. But that's one of the big lies. This is not a new virus. This is a virus that is very closely related to viruses that have been broadly circulating in the human population for eons. It's a new variation of that SARS virus that caused a little bit of a panic in 2003, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so closely related that they could use the genes, the genetic material from that original SARS virus from 2003, to develop the testing protocols. It's what in the World Health Organization doesn't even call it a separate subspecies of SARS.
Yeah.
It's what's known as an individual. You know, what you and I are to each other. We're the same species. And so there's a bit of a lie in the idea, a big lie, if you ask me, in the idea that this is a new virus. And it causes people to rush to the conclusion that everybody is susceptible. And nothing could be further from the truth. So I suspect that there's a big story in prior immunity from other similar infections. And it could be recent ones or ancient ones.
Yeah.
It could be that our immune system is designed to deal with viruses
This brings us to the vaccine, which I'm sure is now going to become the next issue of contention and debate, because human beings just can't seem to do anything by consensus anymore. There have to be two polar opposites on television battling it out for anybody to feel like something is being handled in the immature way that we seem to want to handle everything these days, including everything becoming politicized. So vaccines shouldn't be politicized. It shouldn't be a political issue. If they make the vaccine available, and there are all kinds of questions around how they're going to distribute that vaccine in South Africa, any one of the different vaccines, because there are a number of different ones that are being developed by different pharmaceutical companies now. What is Panda's take on the vaccine, and what do you think is going to happen? Big questions and unfair questions, but I'm going to give you a go anyway.
No, it's fine. Totally fine. I mean, we're happy to, we'll always limit our comments where we can't make them. But the first thing Panda thinks about the vaccine is that Panda's very annoyed by having to start every conversation by saying, we are not anti-vax.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, as soon as you start asking an intelligent question about the process or the safety or the efficacy or the who's being targeted with the vaccine, as soon as you start asking those questions, some shrieking Karen in a corner starts stabbing her finger at you, calling you anti-vax.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, completely immature discourse. So we're not anti-vax. We look at this and say, okay, what are we comparing it to? How does the vaccine perform relative to the human immune system for non-vulnerable people? Has that question really been answered and addressed? What does the vaccine trial actually show us? Because all that the trials that we've seen show is that they prevented the generation of the sniffles, the incidence rate of the sniffles amongst healthy people.
Mm.
Didn't really show us what happens when you inject this to somebody who's already been infected or into a vulnerable person. That hasn't really been shown to our satisfaction. Why did we skip out key steps? The urgency? Well, wow, because vaccines have been known to have quite long-term side effects in some cases. Why did we skip out the animal trials? Why is nobody talking about the incredible conflicts of interest on all of these government bodies, the SAGE in the UK, our own MAC? We've got people who essentially get their money and their grants and their funding, their incomes, from vaccine manufacturers making the decision about whether the vaccines are safe or not.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's, if you want to design a system for failure, that's how you do it. And it's not just isolated aspects. If you go and look at the SAGE list in the UK, where they've been a bit more transparent about funding sources and so on, every single person is conflicted. There isn't a person who's not. And so when you look at that situation where you've got big pharma standing to make a lot of money after having a couple of decades of real leanness, where the corners have been cut left, right, and center, where there's patent lobbying going on, you have to be concerned and you have to ask questions. And it's astonishing for me that mainstream media has not been asking any of those questions. It's almost as if they've been captured as well.
Hmm. What do you say, Pums? What do you say about this vaccine?
For me, like everything else, one of the things that have been the consequence of the pandemic is it's been laid bare to us how far down the road we have come. What we're seeing here is we're seeing the greed and the self-preservation of companies and how much of a role they have come to play in how policy gets driven. And we're just seeing it more clearly here. This is always how they have been. This is how they've been operating, but we haven't been in a heightened sense of being vigilant about who is, as you say, Nick, is the guys are being paid, their grants come from pharmaceutical companies. That has been the case for all their research, for all of the things that they do. It's just that now that we are so acutely aware, we are suddenly looking at it and going, but wait a minute, why are those people in bed with each other? That's what this pandemic has done, is it's just laid it bare. We've always known about the greed of pharmaceutical companies. We've always known how insidious governments are and how closely they work with these people and how everybody's got a self-interest that they are protecting. Now, because it affects so many more of us and we're so attuned to it that we are complaining about it, but we haven't complained about it before. I'm glad people are beginning to realize and that the wool has fallen off people's eyes. This is just how the world has been working. Big capitalist agenda pushing ahead, and it's crashing us now.
Yeah, Bimi, you're absolutely right, and I do worry about is it a capitalist agenda? It's actually just an agenda of corruption. You know, corruption can take place in the public and private sector, as happening in both. You know, and so it's corrupt private businesses, corrupting science, corrupting media, in my opinion, and this situation is serious. I mean, vaccines are like anything else in the world; they have a cost and a benefit.
Sure.
And you can't just continue adding to the list of vaccines that you shove into people without paying any attention to the cost and the benefits, and just talking only about the benefits. You know, that practice is just fundamentally unsound. Yet that is what we're doing. The list of things people are being vaccinated for is growing and growing and growing, and there are consequences to that, negative consequences. One of the immunologists on our team uses the analogy of saying, when you take a vaccine, you're taking a crowbar to a Swiss watch. And what he means by that is it's a rather clumsy punch to your immune system, which is a highly complex and amazingly if effective system for dealing with not just viruses, but all sorts of other pathogens that have been waging war over probably hundreds of millions of years, if not billions of years, with the species that they co-inhabit the earth with. And he says, you've got to be mindful of that. You can't just hand those punches out left, right, and center because some guy in a white coat from a pharmaceutical company told you this is good for you. I've conducted a study, and those scientists in government who have been driving and lobbying for years say so.
You know how I counter this imbalance in the world, Pums, that you refer to, is I buy shares in AstraZeneca, and at the same time I refuse to take I refuse to take the vaccine until I've seen at least 1,000 people pass through it.
If you ask any new age mother, any person who's become a mother in the past 15 years, about their experience, they can tell you for free. You talk about medicating and over-medicating and vaccines for this and that.
Yeah.
I actually had I had a serious fight with a group of teachers about the fact that childhood is not a disease. But the way that we encounter the human body now, you know, everything needs to be medicated. You think about even antibiotics like an augmentin, right? Speaking about taking crowbars, is you'd essentially take an antibiotic that just kills everything simply because the doctor's going, something's wrong with you, I'm not sure what it is, broad spectrum antibiotic, kill everything and then start from scratch. This is how medicine works. This is how
science
works.
Yeah, they get handed off like candy.
So, Nick, where are we at? I've heard lots because people love, you know, ordinary, stupid people. I mean, I've got people like this in my group of friends, my family, people I really expected more from, that can't wait to hear from Cyril again and that are already passing around information, a lot of it that even the presidency's had to decry as fake news, that we're going to level 5. And this may happen. You never know. Don't underestimate the stupidity of the National Coronavirus Command Council. But at the same time, The population of stupid people almost deserve a government of stupid people. What do you foresee happening with level three? Do you think they're going to call it off after the next 5 or 6 or 7 days? And where are we going to go after this? Because Boris Johnson has locked down the UK. They're arresting groups of people who gather more than two people. Soon there'll be snipers on the roof, no doubt, taking out people who walk out of their houses in Britain. It's all become a bit weird. And we thought 2020 was weird. 2021 might be even weirder. What do you forecast?
I'm afraid to say that I forecast further sinister developments. You were right early on. I can't remember in what context we were talking, but you were right to talk about the moving goalposts. Even as the vaccine is being rolled out with much fanfare and huge pressure, all sorts of threats of immunity passports and this kind of thing to people who don't take it. Mm-hmm. Even as that's all happening, you see Bill Gates and the World Health Organization and any number of government officials starting to say that, but don't get ahead of yourselves. Even if we roll out the vaccine, we're going to still have to continue with restrictions in place.
Yeah.
Because the vaccine hasn't been proven to stop transmission or to prevent death. it's just mind-boggling for me. And I am concerned that we stumble from excuse to excuse. And you see manipulation happening. And they're not even hiding it. Our Mac has a group of people who are basically behavioral experts, and their purpose is to sit there coming up with amp up the fear after each cycle or each issue disappears, and they need a new one, a new variant, we move from one thing to the next. So I am very concerned that we are far from getting out of this downward spiral.
Wanted to say something on
in
that?
In respect of what has turned out to be much less threatening, something that's much less threatening.
Here in South Africa, guys, we are also, let us not forget, in an election year. This is what every politician prays for in the year of an election, something that will make them relevant. And this is going to be something going into August, I think, is when the election is supposed to happen. Oh, believe me, the politicians are going to milk this. They're going to milk this.
And Pumi, I'm so glad you brought that up, because obviously, that people are looking at opportunities here. It's not just the pharmaceutical companies looking to profiteer. It's also politicians looking to exploit situations to their own advantage. You're absolutely right. But there's also another further complication to South Africa, and that is that we have a huge divide between rich and poor. And undoubtedly, rich people will more or less be okay. A lot of there's going to be a huge amount of upset in their lives too, but not nearly to the extent that poor people's lives have been disrupted by lockdowns. And Nick, have we started to calculate in real terms the cost of this for impoverished South Africans and South Africans who've lost their job over the last year? And the total cost to the economy. I mean, government are going to be looking at budgets which are so constrained. Tito Mboweni's probably looking at the balance sheet now and looking at the end of February and thinking, oh my God, what am I going to tell people and where am I going to get money? And that obviously is a recipe for disaster too, because if government don't have money and they can't pay things like the state services and welfare, social grants, which they're eventually not going to be able to pay because people are sick of lending them money too, where does that put us?
I mean, I think the long-term economic impacts are where we have to be concerned, and I haven't seen a whole lot of research on that, of the nature of the work that we did. I do feel that we are dealing with a government that is now functionally incapacitated. It's done. You know, the damage is done. The tax revenues have fallen. They're not going to come back in a hurry. There seems to be an incredible irrational kind of avoidance of talking about the real problem. You know, you saw that with the whole SAA story. If a minister's going to spend his time on something in a situation like this, it's not trying to breathe life into the shattered corpse of the national airline. I mean, come on. That's one of the most ridiculous things you can do. And what that speaks to is the degree of a kind of a failure to actually embrace reality. This idea that we'll be able to borrow our way out of it, you know, that and the debt will have no consequence because it's just, you know, it's debt to ourselves. You know, so that we don't have to worry about it. We can just carry on racking up borrowings. Well, that's like that's almost as immature as the whole approach of lockdown, you know, in terms of it's the economic version of lockdown, in the sense that it just doesn't even bear a moment's scrutiny. So I think we are in for seriously difficult economic times. My belief is that counts at the election. I hear you, Pumi, that, you know, it's easy for a leader to appear big and bold when he's appearing. He's getting all this airtime and all the scared people are saying, go Cyril, you know. But I think when the reality comes to bite and people start really suffering, as they are doing, it's already happening. It's just not being reported. I took a drive through the township up here in Knysna the other day. I like to do my own sort of on the ground research, and you can just see it. The looks of desperation. The town here has been gutted in terms of its jobs and its revenues. And stupid moves like these recent ones just deepen it further. I think when people start getting truly desperate, that is going to become politically almost impossible.
Well, I didn't want us to finish on a pessimistic note like that, but we're out of time.
Okay.
And otherwise, otherwise I'd have you give us some element of hope, but you can always go and check out the Panda website. Give us the details of that so people can follow the work that you guys are doing and keep themselves appraised of this so that we can start having sensible conversations instead of reacting emotionally to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And a good time to recommend that people visit pandata.org. We've just posted a series of interviews up there with some lovely scientists, some people who see the world more sensibly, and people have responded incredibly positively to those. Dr. Wolfgang Vodag and Professor Jay Bhattacharya, the two interviews in particular that I would draw people's attention to.
Right.
So it's pandata.org. And
good.
Also subscribe for our newsletter. We've got a Telegram channel. We've got a Twitter feed, Facebook, LinkedIn. So whatever your poison is, jump on and have a look. And take a look at how our advisory board is growing and the caliber of the scientists who are joining our effort.
Wow, thank you. Pumi, thank you as always. And thank you to Nando's for making it possible for us to do this every single week on the Burning Platform. Nick Hudson is with Panda. You can find out more about them by going to pandata.org. Very good.
Thank you, Pumi. Thank you, Gareth. And good luck to all your listeners out there. I hope things normalize faster than I'm expecting.
Well, you know, in the words of Boris Johnson, stay home, protect the NHS, stay safe. CliffCentral.com